Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big Pop. Fun. Radio. It's the Big Pop Fun Man, Tom Wilson.
Hi, everybody. Hey, let's get this show on the road. What do you say? I mean, thank you, Jeff Harlan, for all of your wonderful and well-modulated announcements and introductions of the podcast. But sometimes we've just got to get this show on the road. Welcome to the Big Pop Fun Podcast with Tom Wilson. I'm trying to be well-modulated myself because I guess I've cheated Jeff out of his time. So now I'm being announcer-like. Although, as I've talked about before in the story fugue of this podcast, I can't be an announcer guy because I almost have an announcer voice, but not quite. There's always a guy with, you know, mutton chops eating French toast behind me who has a way better, richer, more buttery voice than I have. He does. And his name is Don. Welcome back to another magical sleigh ride of enchantment and wonder as we enter our sleigh and put our faux fur covers and blankets over ourselves because we wouldn't want to upset those PETA people because, well, we don't mind upsetting them, but they end up bringing paint and pouring it on our expensive fur blankets, so we can't have that. So let's use our faux fur blankets and snuggle up and look back on so many wonderful podcasts, but last week's as a noteworthy one. For all of you who listened to last week's podcast, Tom Solo's Life, thanks for, you know, a few people contacted me and said it meant something to them, and that, of course, means the world to me. From the very beginning of this podcast, I think freely admitted to you that I don't know what I'm doing. I'm not even particularly comfortable with it. I don't know where we are, modern or postmodern or meta or wherever we are in the state of our culture, where we must be more and more transparent in order to continue to be a viable performing artist, a viable artist, a viable, almost viable human being, isn't it? Since we have Facebook and Twitter and everything, and to not do those things is almost to say I'm not. If I remove myself from the radar screen of life, I will be removed from life. But I don't think that's true. I still don't. And for those of you who heard the podcast number one, Big Pop Fun One, where I told some stories, my finger is still poised above the J.D. Salinger button. So, and the big movie came out in J.D. Salinger, or it's called Salinger and a book about Salinger. And, of course, I so love the work of J.D. Salinger, so admire him as a writer, so oddly identify with his reticence about participation in popular culture after his experience with The Catcher in the Rye. But the reviews were so bad of the movie and the book that me, a guy who's really was really waiting for it to come out and was really looking forward to it, didn't see the movie, don't plan to, and won't see the book, and won't look at the book. Isn't that weird? But I've got nothing against these guys, but I don't understand, you know, it's probably interesting interviews that they did in the movie with, I guess, Edward Norton or Philip Seymour Hoffman or different people talking about J.D. Salinger. But hey, if I were you, me, Tom Wilson, was being interviewed in a documentary about Salinger, I wouldn't watch me. So I'm going to move on right now because you may be, yeah, well, fast forward through the Salinger talk. Anyway, welcome back. I recommend listening to last week's podcast if you haven't, Tom Solo's Life. But it was a little deeper, a little more visceral, a little closer to the bone, maybe than any podcast that I've done personally, maybe. But people responded to it, and they thanked me for it, and I appreciate that very much. So thank you very much to those of you who listened and felt, got touched by it or whatever, and reached out to me through email, info@tomwilsonusa.com, through postcards or whatever at P.O. Box 18106, Encino, California, 91416, USA. But thank you. This podcast is always brought to you by art, so please support artists wherever you are. My friend, let's plug David Darrow again. Dave's just a good painter and a nice guy. So Darrow Art, DarrowArt.com. Look up Dave's work and buy a print from the guy. Or just look at some of his art and email him and say, I looked at your art and I just enjoyed it. That was 2.5 minutes on the internet that were actually worthwhile, that meant something to me. So thanks for that. But support art wherever you are, because there are a lot of artists doing really interesting things with their lives and putting it out there for people to see and enjoy and even buy. So think about buying something from an artist, or if you have it, if that itch is happening within you, why not do it yourself? It's time. Hey, it's, what is it, October now? Is it October already? Yes. Start making things now for those Christmas presents. Yes, your nephew will look at it quizzically, and your nephew's parent, your brother and your sister-in-law, will make him say thank you, though he hates the painting that you made for him. But you and I know that when he's 27 years old and that painting is up in his house, that will be one of his most prized possessions, and he will take it wherever he goes for the rest of his life. Although now, yeah, he wants whatever Hot Wheels they have right now, unless he's 19, in which case he might want Hot Wheels, but then, I don't know, then he's a special Hot Wheels guy that wants Hot Wheels. My guest today, it's a guest podcast. I've had so many solos in a row because I think as we've become so incredibly close to the supersaturation point of the podcast, where it seems now everyone has one and everyone is on them. Now when I'm emailing people or calling them, even friends to be on the podcast, it's like, yeah, I just did 7 podcasts in the past 3 weeks, and I'm hosting my own, so maybe we could do it next month. So it's interesting that the paucity of guests now, or makes it actually challenging. So we'll see what we're doing here with the Big Pop Fun. But my podcast this week, after last week's, I just couldn't have. I don't know. I couldn't have a stuntman friend just tell me about falling off buildings. When I was in college, I was a person of a spiritual bent, and this might be story fugue, but I was considering, hey, what am I supposed to do in life? What does God want me to do in my life? Is there something happening here? Does the cosmos, is it steering me somewhere? And because I had this the circle of friends and the experiences that I'd had with youth groups and church groups, I was considering becoming a priest. And I talked to a priest at Arizona State University, where I was going to school, and we made plans to meet. I was going to talk to him and say, well, Father Tom, I'm actually considering becoming a priest, and what will we do, or what do you think about that? And look, fact is, as you know, by listening to any of these podcasts, oh man, that would have been just a train wreck. Oh man, I would have been terrible at it. I would have been terrible at anything where, you know, where people tell you to do stuff and you just have to do it. I'm just not, you know, I was not given that gene. And I know it's a bad thing. I don't do that born to be wild. I don't listen to no, I say, like, I really, that's a problem with me, because it's this thing where if people say, no, you have to go here and you have to do that, I immediately just go, why do I have to? So that would have been terrible. But the fact is, the time came for me to meet with this Father Tom guy. And I went to this chapel and I was saying a prayer, you know, that God would lead this or whatever I was supposed to do in my life. And the time came that we were supposed to meet. And Father Tom didn't show up. And he didn't show up for a long time, like a half hour. And I went into the offices, like, is Father Tom around? You know, can we reach him? They're, no, we can't. He's somewhere. We thought he was coming back. So, well, when he comes in, would you tell him that I'm waiting for him? Because we had that meeting. Went back in the chapel. And of course, like every kid, I'm expecting, you know, if, hey, God, if this is a sign, like, spin the paintings on the walls. Make me look, make my eyes turn into kaleidoscopes, and I'll just see everything in weird colors that are shifting, and I'll know this or that. But I waited there in the chapel for 3 hours. And at the end of the 3 hours, I kind of looked up and went, okay, so I guess I got my answer. And I went off, and I lived life, and yes, as I said, I would have been... Look, they would have thrown me out of there on a rail, man. It wouldn't have worked out. But as I talked to you about my my friend Father Joe, a friend of our family, when I was growing up, and my aunt was a sister of the Immaculate Heart sister, and you know, so within this Irish Catholic experience in the East Coast, there are many nuns, priests, friends of our families, family members, and I thought it would be interesting to talk to one of the podcast. So, my friend, Ron Young, or officially the Reverend Ronald Wayne Young, OMI, an Oblate of Mary Immaculate, is my guest this week. I think priests, let's face it, look, I know many of you are already turning it off, the podcast, and going to the next one. But I just think that, and believe me, I've got my problems too with the whole thing. I'm a dissident quite a number of times, and I'm, well, let's not get into that, or we'll really kind of melt the microphone here. But priests are, within our popular culture, portrayed as two things. The innocent lamb priest who's never really seen anything dirty or heard any bad words, and he's in a commercial stealing a hostess Twinkie. Oh, Father, you stole... It's either that guy or it's Satan himself, of course, you know, abusing children in horrible ways and just, you know, evil incarnate. And nothing is presented in the middle. And I find the men that I know are, they're fascinating guys with interesting lives and interesting stories. Father Ron wasn't that crazy about this interview I did with him because he felt that I was a little deferential. You know, I was a little, I took off the boxing gloves, which I didn't want to have a fight. We have, believe me, we have our great disagreements that sometimes we explore, sometimes heatedly. But I just wanted to talk to him and ask some questions about his life, and I thought it might be interesting. And I thought you might too. So here's my conversation with Father Ron Young. I'm talking to Ronald Wayne Young, OMI. What are all your letters at the end of your name?
Oblate of Mary Immaculate.
Yes. So OMI and then your educational stuff. You're all educated and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a doctorate in theology, in missiology from the Pontifical Gregorian University, and a license from there in the same field in missiology. And I have a master's degree in theology from the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. And my master's divinity from there. And I have my bachelor's in theology from Creighton University in Omaha.
So not, you don't have like a, like one of those associate's degrees in recreation from UC Santa Cruz or something?
I have an A degree in liberal studies.
But you went to Berkeley, didn't you?
I did.
When did you study there? Well, let's start with, you're my buddy. It's Father Ron Young. And you are... you're a great guy and a buddy, but we go to breakfast periodically, and yes. I'm outside your house in the San Fernando Valley, the north part of the San Fernando Valley, a very small, nicely kept house, but very small. And you point to the house and you say, yeah, I came to this house when I was 3 years old. I was raised here with my with 16 brothers and sisters.
Right.
And I just, and the back of my head blew off. In this, I mean, you have to see this very small house, 16 kids.
Yes.
With your dad.
Yes.
Who's not your biological father, and your, but your mom and your dad, who took you in.
Those were our foster parents.
Yes. Yeah. And your dad and mom took in 16 kids.
Yes.
Of various ages, a lot of different ages. I mean, from
ages, races, economic and social backgrounds. Mom did not raise such questions. She was devoted to the idea that there shouldn't be no child that was unwanted. So when they asked, she always said yes.
Uh-huh.
And they asked 16 times, and she said yes.
And they just, the foster people or the municipal people who handle the children would just come to them.
Social workers, right.
The social workers, there were
They knew it was a quality home, and there weren't, you know, there's not a plethora of those, you know, where the children really are the priority, and it's not about making money. And my parents always lost money on the deal. They always lost part of their own money on with all the kids. And I remember one of my little sisters was a Hispanic, Linda Sue. She was so abused in those days that they knew she would die. So mom took her in as long as she would live, and she lived about a little less than a week and died in mom's arms. And it didn't matter. Mom was devoted to the idea that no child would be unwanted around her. And that was her principle. That's what she stuck by. And dad, of course, he loved her. And I think that he tolerated her attitude because, you know, he'd go off to work and then he'd come home and she'd say, oh, we have another child. She'd say, okay, more the merrier, and just go on, you know.
And your dad, and I'll get off this topic soon, but your dad is an amazing figure. I mean, your dad was like a World War II hero. He flew in bombing missions.
Yeah, he was a bottom gunner. I forget what the technical word for that is.
Belly gunner?
But yeah, he rode in the little bubble in the bottom of the plane, and, you know, was a gunner. But it was in the early part of the war when the flak could easily reach the planes. They had to fly at a certain altitude lower than the flak itself. So they lost planes by the dozens. There are at least two or three campaigns where only two planes came back, and he happened to be on one of the two. So for surviving 25 missions in those days of the war, they awarded everybody, because of just survival was a miracle, the second highest medal that the country could offer, a Distinguished Flying Cross. So he did his tour in World War II, 25 missions, and out. And then he signed up for Korea and did his tour there and was shot down. He was a spotter in a spotter plane out in front of the action. And he was shot down doing his job. And, you know, plane comes down and was shot down twice, actually, and went up again, and he got shot down again.
Which one did he get injured at, the first?
The second one.
Because when I met him, you know, you meet an older man like that, and how old is he now?
He's 89.
89?
We're celebrating his 90th birthday.
Almost 90. And so I meet him. He's a wonderful part of American history. And he says, give me your finger. Now, when an older man says, give me your finger, you expect one thing to happen. So you're thinking, okay, I've heard this. He takes my finger, puts it up against his jawline, and you can feel the bumps and ridges like of carpentry work.
Yes.
There are screws that say, oh, yep, I got shut down, you know, in Korea and everything. They had to rebuild my entire face and everything.
That's true.
So he's an amazing figure.
You're in the hospital, and in those days, of course, the technology was not great. So we grew up, you know, going, let me feel the bolt in your, oh, that's the bolt, it's a bolt. But he was a year in the hospital with that. And the best story, of course, about that is when the general came to award him the Purple Heart, he responded, he says, put it on the plane, I survived.
So there's a plane with a Purple Heart somewhere in Korea.
Somewhere.
Now, so he survived all of these bombing missions.
Yes.
So Father Ron, did he survive because God wanted him to raise 16 children in Sylmar, California? Or did he just survive? What do you think?
Well, I think the kind of man he is survived, meaning he was already a generous person. He'd been through the Great Depression, and he'd supported his own family for many years, and when the country needed him, he left that and went off to support his country. He was already a greatly, tremendously generous person. So did God let him survive all that so he could take foster children in? It's very likely, but I think he was generous. He learned how to be more generous, so that he could prepare himself to do exactly what he chose to do. Did God prepare him for that? Oh, yes, I think so. Because they never had much in life. They never did world tours or traveled a lot or anything. They never could with all those kids. But for them, the joy of their life was their kids. So for them, that was the party. And I think that they had their values right. I don't think it was about, well, what have we seen, the Eiffel Tower, or, you know, do we have the latest refrigerator or whatever. It was about how do we raise quality people. And they really dedicated their life and their time and their treasure and all their talent to that. He also coached Little League and, you know, did all kinds of very generous things for young people. So it's his nature, as it was hers. And they were in tune. Whatever their life had been before, it prepared them to be in tune with that part of their nature, which I consider very close to the divine.
Right, right. And they weren't, and you weren't raised, I mean, you're a priest now, you weren't raised, they weren't Catholics.
They weren't Catholic. Mom was Methodist. And as far as we knew, Dad was Church of Christ.
Uh-huh.
After Mom passed, it was about a couple years. Remember, I'd been through all kinds of vow ceremonies and ordination ceremonies and stuff, graduations, and they'd had to come to all this, being my parents.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd kind of gone through a reintroduction to the Catholic Church.
And when was that in high school for you, or what? Had you gone to college, or you went to college specifically in order to become a priest? Or was it like you had...
My conversion was when I was 17. I was still
About the end of high school.
Uh-huh. And because I graduated at 17, so it was right around that time.
Uh-huh.
And then I went to a new community college in the area called Los Angeles Mission College, which a lot of the church people confuse for a Catholic school.
Right,
and
right.
And then I went from there to Northridge, Cal State Northridge. Then I went to Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska. And then I went to the Franciscan School of Theology and the Graduate Theological Union at the same time for my master's degrees, and then off to Rome.
So when you had this, whatever, this conversion experience at 17, why didn't you become a Methodist, or why didn't you become a Church of Christ minister or do something like that?
Well, the experience itself kind of precludes wandering, because at 15 I contacted diabetes, and by 16 I'd almost died from it. Nobody really understood what was happening. I was losing weight like no tomorrow, and it was quite serious and really bad, and literally within 24 hours of death by the time they caught it and started the rehabilitation, rebuilding the muscles and stuff. But concurrent with that, see, I'd already prayed and loved God from the time I was about 12. And so, you know, the great common question is, you know, why would God, who knows that I try to help people and do good things and love people, why would God let this happen to me? Why would God let me almost die from such a terrible disease, and an embarrassing disease? I mean, it was really debilitating in so many ways. So that was what I was stuck with. So I realized that maybe trying to do this Christian thing alone was not workable. And so I better start searching for some other people who might share my faith. And as I searched, I went around to Methodists and Presbyterians and all kinds of other churches. And they were good in their own way, but I didn't feel a sense of belonging. It didn't seem to cause me a big, strong sense. They were good. They're beautiful people, and they're Christians, and they're loving God and so on, but I didn't feel connected in the sense of going to that church. So I finally gave up after a short while, and that was during the time of the Jesus movement, which I, you know, was a part of.
So you were going to kind of meetings or those kind of lots of guitars and kids singing and all those sorts of things.
Don't tell anybody. It was in high school. We were doing it in high school. You know, it's very secularized.
Oh, you were doing it in your public high school.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You were having sort of one of those hippie Jesus
parties.
They
weren't as clear on how, you know, Jesus didn't belong anywhere near children in those days. So, it was very much in that period of the early to middle 70s, it was part of the culture, a movement that was going on in a bunch of high schools as far as I knew. So, that had already been happening for a while, and I really didn't continue. After about five or six tries at different churches, I thought, well, that's really nice, but I'm just going to take it easy. And then there was this beautiful young lady that I just found fascinating because she was Hispanic. She was brown, so she had a natural tan, and yet she's just charming Irish accent. And I just found the mix enticing. So
she was kind of, well, they called it black Irish, like my grandfather. She was actually Hispanic looking and very dark, but
no,
she was from Ireland.
Hispanic.
She was
also Irish.
Oh wow, that's amazing.
Who lived in Ireland for a while?
Yeah.
So,
because they have many people from Spain that went to Ireland so many well, hundreds of years ago. Even my grandfather had black hair and a black mustache, and he could have he could have played a Cuban in a movie.
She was the real thing, and I just found it charming. So I wanted to take her on a date, and the only way to get to a Hispanic girl is through the mother. You can't get there any other way. Even a date, you won't get anywhere near that child unless you get through the mother. So every day I would greet the mother and say, hello, good to see you. Oh, you look wonderful today. And just, you know, move on and trying to make points with the mother. And, of course, they all know it's the dance. And I don't know what happens today, but in those days, that was the dance. And so finally the mother says to me, you can have a date with my daughter if you come to one Catholic Mass. So I thought, well, the price is right. Let's go. I've been to all kinds of churches. What's this going to do? So I go, and which I think is good theological proof that God can use our inadequate intentions to do something far greater than we would ever imagine. I wanted to impress the girl and her family, so I went forward for Holy Communion, not realizing, you know, what that was, or that Catholics believe in the real presence and the permanent presence of the true and living risen Christ in the Holy Eucharist, for us that has profound power attached to it. It is Christ himself, body, blood, soul, and divinity. And I didn't realize any of that. I just wanted to impress the girl. So I went and received Holy Communion, and all of a sudden I had like experience that had three parts to it. The first part, each part meant something to me.
Like, what did you do? Did you received your communion,
I
you like walked back to a pew,
back,
or
sat down?
And you sat down,
and I had the most powerful 20 seconds of the rest of my life.
You sat down, and it was just that end of 2001: A Space Odyssey kind of thing. I mean, just a
seconds
for 20 seconds.
Yeah, it's not longer. was boom, boom.
Okay, so what would the, it had three parts.
Okay, the first part was I was standing on this mountaintop. It's like the largest mountain you can imagine. When I got the illness that almost took my life, I really felt that nothing seemed to matter anymore. All the etiquette, all this bowing and scraping and acting like humans for each other. Who cares? It doesn't matter. And it reality kind of fell away from me, and I didn't see the point in all of this worldly relationship stuff. And when I had the experience, the mountain, what my interpretation was that the mountain was in fact God, and that God was actually the foundation under everything. So we should take everything in life very seriously, because God is underneath all of this. There's actually God working through everything that we just think is arbitrary and accidental and so on.
And to the pew, you brought, you know, before you sat down, you had that kind of absurdist worldview. What does anything mean?
Yes.
It's all a pile of, you know.
It was at that moment.
Yeah. And then God was the rock or the mountain under everything.
Right.
That there is a reality.
I was standing on him. In other words, I was fine. As long as I stood on this mountain, everything's cool. I wasn't falling anymore. It wasn't free fall. And a free fall is without morality. I really imagined that certain philosophers who emphasize the will and the inventing their reality in God and asserting it and forcing it, I imagine that they're in free fall, that they can't see anything around them, so they're going to build it themselves. Well, it's already been built, and it already has significance. We just have to pay attention to the connections between the foundation and what it's becoming, because things grow out of that mountain, of course. Everything grows out of that mountain. And then the second experience I had was a sense of being purified. And it was like, you know those sparklers that they used to give on the 4th of July?
Sure, the kids run around holding you.
Well, it was like sparklers going up and down my body, just once, but it was up and down. And I realized that I was being purified, that I was in the presence of something very holy, and that I was unworthily in that presence, and that I required some form of purification. And that whatever that was in the bread, because I wasn't sure that it, you know, at that point, was this a drug-induced state? Did these Catholics put, you know, stuff in their bread? Because drugs were very prevalent in that era. Or what was happening? But, wow, that was, you know, so I had the sense that I was being purified from something. It didn't matter what it was. There could be a million things. And then the third thing that happened is I started experiencing this very burning, this passionate, powerful love, this amazing, it's a yearning love. And it wasn't for me. It wasn't directed to me. Nobody was loving me one iota more. It was actually directed to all the other people in the room coming out of my heart. And I realized it was God's feeling, God's sense of wanting these people in heaven and wanting them to be fulfilled and satisfied and made whole and complete, live a full and complete life, wanting for them, and that he was using my heart to facilitate that, to make that happen, that I was sharing in the wanting. And it was perhaps, I would say, the most profound love that I have yet to experience, because it's a real hope. It's not realized. It's like, we can do this. You can do this. We can do this. Let's do this together. I need you, but come on. We can move it. Let's go. It's really motivated loving, okay? And very powerful. It's the most powerful force that I can imagine. That's moving everything. It's all bent so that people will find a sense of themselves, a sense of their inner beauty and their affirmation and their sense of goodness, and not in things external to themselves, but in themselves. and discovery and wonder in the divine and a sense of joy at living the commitments we make and becoming the person that is worthy of the glory of heaven. It's wanting all of that for people. And that was the 20 seconds. That was it.
That was it.
And that's when I decided to become a Catholic.
Wow. The only question in a podcast like this, where I'm trying to talk to people involved in the culture in very many different ways, and you present a 20-second authentic experience that was as real to you as anything that's happened in your life, maybe the most real thing that's ever happened to you. Mm. It in today's culture, it sounds crazy.
Mm.
It's an absolute. Well, what am I trying to say? It's an anachronism. They're trying to sell it as, isn't it?
Well,
or you are a paradox.
I would not. I don't think I'm exceptional. I think people have true moments, moments that express the drama of the long drive of their life in a few vows, in a few glances of the eye, in the gift that overwhelms with generosity. And people have true moments. I think everybody has those. Now, I think it's also true to say that some people have kind of calloused their heart. They've kind of tried to blind themselves to those true moments, because true moments always are life-changing and always will challenge the heck out of the receiver. I mean, I was left with the question, after all this jazz, I was left with the question, oh, what now? And I had not a clue that God would ask of me to consider religious life and vowing poverty and chastity and obedience. I would have been more than happy with a family of 11. Mm-hmm. No woman, I think, would have been overly delighted, but I would have been just fine with that. Or that God would honor me with the grace of priestly ordination, diaconal ordination, that God would call me to follow my education to the point of a doctorate and become a professor. No. I'll tell you where I was at that point in my life when I was just graduating high school. The career advisor that I had, he was a real winner. And we sat down and he said, Ron, given your grades and your qualifications and your interest, I think silk screening is right up your alley. So, he wanted me to silk screen T-shirts for a living.
Really? The career counselor really was saying, think about a T-shirt business.
Yes, that's absolutely what I was best suited for. Okay.
Boy, those counselors are really useful, aren't they?
Oh, they just...
They really are terrific.
100% accuracy in my case. So I told him where he could fly his T-shirt, and I didn't know what else I was going to do, but it wouldn't involve silk screening T-shirts. And obviously God had better plans, a better use for my minimal skills and abilities than that.
So you ended up flying in the face of a lot of the culture, of a lot of what you had prepared to do in life, and decided to be a Catholic priest, which you have been now for how long?
Well, next year is my 25th year, I think.
Is it? 25. Have you enjoyed it?
Yeah. I do it again. I mean, it has its hard points and its easy points, right? Life is life for everybody. Has that? It's not just one long skate up to heaven, you know. Uh-huh. But I signed on because I love adventure. I love a challenge. I enjoy excitement and the trying new things and meeting new people and all that. And it has kept its promise. I adventures by the score, challenges by the truckload, excitement unbelievable, and new people around every corner. So I'm not unhappy at all. It makes me the most creative I can imagine being.
And, of course, to many people listening, they would want to hear, does it hurt your feelings to undergo the denigration that the Catholic priest has undergone in the past, say, 10 years within the culture at large?
Does it hurt my feelings?
Does it hurt your feelings? Because when I'm out there and I'm seeing things and you see the Facebook entries and you see all sorts of things from television programs and everything, and of course it's designed to minimize many men and women who've given their lives to serving others and to serving God, and to try to cheapen it and, you know, duct tape it to all of the problems that there have been.
I remember I was in Rome and Mother Teresa passed away, now blessed Mother Teresa. And I read in a newspaper editorial someone who said, they actually wrote this in the news of the day, in the Herald or whatever that was. They wrote, Mother Teresa has already received her reward. She doesn't require any celebration or no one should remember her because she was working for heaven anyway. And so we shouldn't recognize anything she offers because it was just for heaven and not for us. And I thought, you really don't get anything. You don't understand even the smallest element of her life. I have to say, I don't take it personally that there are crises. There's always been crises. I don't take it personally that lawyers are greedy. There's always been greedy lawyers. That's not news. I don't take it personally that some priests are dysfunctional. I do take it personally if you try to stretch that to say that all priests are dysfunctional based on the 2 or 3% of dysfunctional priests that there are. That's 96 to 7 to 8% functional priests. If you take all the dysfunctional families, and I have a sister who's a marriage and family counselor, and I challenge her and I say, you know, a lot of your definitions of dysfunctionality, I think they might have an economic basis. There, you really beat the bushes to increase your market share. You're trying to find things so that people will feel needy, so they'll come for counseling to you. But you know what? Even with some small measure of dysfunction, we're perfectly normal. In fact, according to Freud, if we're not neurotic, something's wrong. So I think that I take it very personally when they try to stretch the idea that in order to live the priestly life, in order to belong in the service of God's people, in order to be someone for the good of the church and for the sake of the world, something has to be wrong with you. That's just stupid, in my opinion, and ignorant, and I have no greater insult than that. But I understand in our society, deep pockets win out, and that's what I suspect much of the hue and cry of lawyers is all about. Not that there are no abused people, but that the lawyers play the game to win as much money as they can win. And that's how our society works. However, I would also like to say, since I belong to the organization that invented hospitals and orphanages and libraries as public institutions and all kinds of other things that people take for granted nowadays, it is our firm conviction that we love and believe in and continue to serve humanity in the name of Jesus Christ, whom we adore as God. And we make no apologies, neither for our love for people nor our adoration of Christ.
And you're just going to get hit with stones, but you must continue. Noblesse oblige. The obligation of a nobility such as yourself or any Christian person, that it's in the pamphlet, it's in the membership book. Bad things are going to happen and people are going to hate you.
Well, they can. I mean, you can't control how people react. That's not my worry. My worry is their well-being, really, their well-being. Are they doing well? Are they improving? Is life going better for them on a whole list of levels? And is the truth coming out about things? Is reality being affirmed? Because we live in such an advertiser's paradise that oftentimes reality gets missed and people confuse the advertising or the publicity or whatever for the reality. And I think it's part of the church's job, as T.S. Eliot said, to speak the truth. I think the church is called to say it plain, what we see, and take whatever comes with that. That's not a popularity contest. That's a fact check. That's let's do our very best to represent in a responsible, adult, and honest way the person, the being that we represent, and do it accurately and adequately. That's we represent Jesus Christ, by the way, so we have to do our very best.
I was having a conversation with a friend the other day, and I said off the top of my head, you know, I think the worst thing that ever happened to Christians around the world was the invention of the microphone or the television camera. And I was being glib, but driving home, I thought, you know, I don't disagree with it that much. It's just, I think human beings are terrible at being important, you know, at becoming important. And with microphones and television cameras, we got, I suppose from the 1950s on, televised spiritual lives, which became very quickly marketing. I mean, what is your take as a guy who, you know, watches TV, sees these people, sees these men and women, you know, asking for the money and promising the things and, you know, you need a car, well, send me $800 and whatever and I'll send you the thing. Probably it's going to happen because Jesus is for winners. And I mean, when you watch that, being a missionary, as you are, and having been around many very poor people, very damaged families, very, very difficult situations all over the world, is that kind of the televisionization or the Americanization of the Christian experience, has that been good?
I think in the whole, it has been good.
You do?
I actually think in the larger measure, it has had a very positive effect on people's lives. As they become less able to be settled and less able to be proximate because of their travel and the frenetic nature of their lives, TV and radio and internet seem able to reach them in the middle of their rushing journey to get wherever they're going. So that is helpful. Even John Paul II, in his encyclical Redemptoris Missio, encourages everyone and invites everyone to use the social media, TV, radio, internet, every signs, publications, everything, to help further the gospel. So it's not been discouraged in our Catholic context. The question is, you know, at what stage of effectiveness are we at in learning how to use it? I would say some places are fairly effective and other places we're pretty darn weak and have a great deal of development to do. But overall in our society, it does cause people to ask the right questions of their lives, even if there's this weird aspect of magical thinking, you know, I give $100, I'm going to get $1,000. I mean, if you're giving it to God and he's going to give you $1,000, why not give him $10,000 and see what you get? Why waste it? That's my first reaction is, go ahead, use the magic and see what happens. It won't work. Secondly, the end of Jesus' story, his earthly story, is the cross. It's not a big, pretty throne where he sits and just he says, "Well, I could have died, but I didn't." No, no. The movie, The Passion of the Christ, reveals very clearly what he went through in order to say a very simple message of "I love you." I went through all of that for a very simple message to say, "I love you all. Now respond to God. Love God." Okay? And I think that our sense of ourselves is changing with the way the message is being delivered. Our identity, our sense of purpose, our feeling of connectedness. I think many times we are unaware that we are not close to other human beings, that we're sitting in a room alone, listening to a computer while the party's going on somewhere else because people are gathered somewhere else. And we're pretending that we're close to people because we give one Facebook message out a day and somebody likes it. Well, it's not the same way of being human as just being with somebody. So I think we're really challenged by technology in terms of both what it can be used for in a positive way to better human life, and what its derogatory nature as a sales kind of atmosphere, where we literally live in compartments as consumers and consume. And I think we have the honest question to ask, am I willing to be boxed that way? Is that my packaging? Is that what I'm willing to accept as my packaging in the world? Or do I want something more, like a human being and a bunch of human beings and just being around them and realizing that it's not the same thing, the online presence and proximate presence to other people? So I think we have used social media to answer the question. Well, I think we could do it better, certainly more effectively. But I also think that we must be very careful and suspicious and discerning people when we listen to some of the voices that want us to turn in the money so that we can get money back from God. When you realize the end of Jesus' story is the cross, and then he's resurrected and raised up and so on and glorified in heaven, but he first had to go through some really difficult times and then die, and Christian life involves some sacrifice, some heroism, some sense of giving one's agenda up for someone else's, meaning God's agenda, and not being always the top winner in the room. That's not going to get you the glory of heaven. God's values, God's ideals are not always the same as the top winner, whoever that is and whatever that purpose is, the top money getter, the most famous personality. These people may not be very impressive to God. They might impress us for 20 seconds, but they don't impress God at all. What impresses God is authenticity, dedication, a sense of your own worth, that you apply that love of self and love of God to your neighbor in practice, that you actually do things that help people and just don't just talk about, "Oh, God, help everybody," or sing about it. God's impressed with looking through the veneer of our self-advertising and seeing to the heart and the reality and the core of what we offer. So I think seeing things with God's eyes, God is not wholly impressed with a lot that we are. And reversely, God is very impressed with a lot of people we don't even notice. And we have to be very careful about how we put on our values in this rather confused society in which we live.
So we were talking about what God expects of us, and we will be surprised at whom God is impressed with.
Mm, I think so.
And we will be surprised that the projection of ourselves and putting ourselves on the pedestal of super Christian, God might not be impressed with that at all.
I don't think so.
So
I think Jesus gives it away when he says, you know, oh, blessed of my Father, you visited me when I was in prison. You fed me when I was hungry. You gave me clothes when I was naked. You helped me. And he's referring to the people that needed that kind of help. I don't think Jesus is keeping it secret. The people that take his way of life seriously aren't doing it for the glamour, and they're not doing it for the money, and they're not doing it for the prestige. They're not doing it because it's popular. They're doing it because it's right. And it's why I do it. It's why almost every clergyman I know, Protestant, Catholic, and otherwise, does it. Sisters do it, the nuns. Brothers do it. And a countless army of lay people, non-ordained, non-vowed, or vowed in marriage, they do it for the right reasons. But they're not doing it to impress. They're doing it because it comes from who they are. And that's the big key to doing things in the right way, knowing who you really are in the eyes of God, gives you all the power you need to respond to his love in an authentic way, in a way that's real. You don't have to beat a drum. You don't have to sound a horn to be somebody. You just have to be his child. That's sufficient. It's enough.
And the big bumper sticker right now is the coexist bumper sticker with the symbols of other faiths in addition to Christianity. Can a Buddhist live like that? Can a Hindu person live like that? Can these various...
the teaching of our church is it is possible. It is difficult. It is very challenging. But it is possible. And it is possible for a Buddhist or a Hindu or people of many different kinds of faiths to go to heaven in the sense that they would essentially be living a Christian life, though calling themselves by another name. It is possible, and God's grace cannot be circumscribed, cut off, or fixed by anyone's words or imagination. We have to be open to the possibility. Having said that, it is also considered highly unlikely, meaning to do that is very difficult and much more difficult than just becoming a Catholic and living a Christian life. It's much more difficult. And so it's not the simple, well, whatever you want to believe, however you want to believe it, God is merciful, so we do whatever we please kind of gospel that a lot of people would like to hear. That would not be honest. That's not honest. Mm-hmm. I know that there are even some Christian denominations that teach once saved, always saved. So once you just say, I'm saved, then you can go do whatever you want and you're automatically in heaven. I'm sorry, we really do not believe that. In fact, in simple fact, we do not even say that all Christians, not even all Catholics, are saved. We don't say that. You actually have to live something. And we say that about everybody. Catholics, non-Catholics, Hebrew, Hindu, the whole crowd. We actually have to live something in accord with divine expectation of how human beings are supposed to treat each other and themselves. And if we live in that, it's very likely we're being inspired by the Spirit of God. It's very likely that we're being inspired by the Spirit of Christ. And God, who is wanting to save us worse than we ever wanted to be saved, and wanting to love us worse than we ever wanted to be loved, will find a way to make that happen. But we shouldn't pretend that salvation's cheap or simple or easy. I think that by, if you're going to respond to the gift of grace, it only requires an entire lifetime. It doesn't require anything more or less than that. Whatever else you do with your life, you better see it as responding to the gift of grace and be living that. If you have any hope for facing off with God at the moment of judgment and him saying, okay, I see all the rest, but I love you. Come on in. He's not a cheap God, and this is not a cheap religion.
So he's not does he have a green eye shade on? Just calculating your good stuff and your bad stuff? Or going, well, you had this.
I don't. He's all knowing, so he doesn't have to calculate. He already knows all that. And in every instance that I can think of, when judgment from human perspective would seem most warranted toward all of us human beings and our behavior in terms of poverty and social injustice, racism, and just purebred ignorance of so many other people, he said, it's mercy I desire, not sacrifice. It's mercy I desire, not sacrifice. It's tenderness. It's kindness. Be loving to each other. You know, be decent people toward each other. Help each other. Bless each other. Don't curse each other. Show each other how to be better people. He's really very clear about all that. What mystifies me is that people misinterpret that as an excuse, another excuse to judge their neighbor. Well, it's not. We don't get any permission of any kind to judge any other individual. We can judge a situation, a case. You know, prejudice is wrong. Stealing from people is wrong. But we can't point fingers and say, you're just terrible, but I'm not. That's not allowed in the religion of Jesus. So we really have to be respectful of our neighbor to the point where we want the best for them. And if we want the best for them, we're going to offer them the potential for heaven, period.
Good stuff. You're a missionary. The oblates, the oblates of Mary Immaculate are missionaries and always were, right, from the very beginning?
Yes.
They were designed to go to other countries and cultures?
Well, they started out in about 1816, 1817 in Marseille, France, as local missionaries. So France had been kind of destroyed by the French Revolution, religiously speaking. They'd moved into very serious secularism. We've never seen anything like it even today. And so in response to that, St. Eugene de Masnard, the founder of my order, founded the missionary oblates to be kind of the replacement clergy for all the clergy that were killed, massacred, and all the religious that were massacred during the French Revolution, which was thousands and thousands of priests and nuns were killed, and brothers. And so we were founded to respond to that within the area of Provence, in that arena in southern France. And then about, I guess, 20 years later, when the community had grown to a sufficient size, St. Eugene wanted to start to branch out into other dioceses. So he went to Rome to ask permission, and they had to get formal approval of the order. And when the order was coming to be formally approved in, I think it was, 18, my years are funny, but I think it's 1821 or something like that. When it was formally approved, the Pope said, you have to be open to missions around the world. At the time, there was a huge missionary effort going to Asia and Africa and the United States even, the Americas per se. Most of it was wilderness and most of it was working with native peoples of all kinds in those days. And so our earliest missions are with native peoples in Canada, in the United States, in southern Africa, and in Sri Lanka.
And did these missionaries work alongside Jesuits, or
no.
they were separate things? They would know. Like, oh, Jesuits have that. They've got that area, and we're going to go over here.
We were some of the earliest missionaries in all of South Africa. We've been there through all of the apartheid thing, and one of our archbishops, Archbishop Hurley, Dennis Hurley, who was one of the deans at the Second Vatican Council because he'd been a bishop for so long. We went through the entire crisis from start to finish with apartheid because we had such a history in that country. No, we had our territories, and we stayed there and did our work as missionaries and essentially founded the Catholic Church in all of those places. They don't realize, you know, the first Catholic chapel in the city of Olympia, Washington, was an oblate chapel. We founded it. We founded all the essential churches of the Pacific Northwest in Washington State and British Columbia and of Western Canada all the way up to the west of the Rockies and up to the Yukon. The Yukon. So we founded all of those communities. Catholic community.
And that's from the east or sailing?
Sailing
around?
Both ways. Some of them came from within Canada, but most of them came from France directly and literally sailed to Southern Africa and sailed to Sri Lanka and sailed to the United States even. They walked the Oregon Trail and just like everybody else and lived like pioneers, etc. So the hardships were huge. And the difficulties were not small, they were immense. And they paid whatever price it was to say to the world, yes, I actually do love God, whatever it takes.
Mm-hmm.
And we continue to pay that price today. Even if it's in ridicule and legal game playing and difficulties and challenges that we face in modern society, it doesn't matter. This is still the same message. I really did experience God in the Holy Eucharist. I really do love him, and I really do love you because of him. And so I continue. It doesn't matter.
And did they go and did they serve the poor up there and build the various things as they'd done on the East Coast? Or is this is the cultural assumption correct that we all hear that they just came to enslave people and give them smallpox from blankets?
No. That's not correct. They came and went and immediately started learning native languages. They ate the food that the natives eat. They lived in the same exact style as the native peoples that they were working with. They didn't live in a grand house. They didn't live in a fancy whatever. They built the way – in fact, most of the resources they had were provided for them by the tribes and or by the local peoples. There was no great distinction except for the fact that they would wear some religious insignia, usually our cassock and mission cross, and then that they would spend their days talking about God and how God loved them and how they could find a way to be with God in the Catholic faith. They essentially would... offer their lives, their fortune, their family, because they were all celibate, of course, their sense of self to the people they were sent to serve. And sometimes that ended up in martyrdom. Sometimes it ends up in conversion. The vast majority of Native peoples actually were indifferent to their missionary work. They didn't care one way or the other. They didn't make any impact. But there's a group that always turns out to be the enemies, and then there's another group that turns out to be the church in that arena. And they always stayed to work with that group. And they didn't try to make enemies, and they certainly didn't try to leave anyone indifferent. But you can't control free people. They left them free not to respond. So when I hear these stories of cultural destruction and all this, I think maybe that gives the missionaries way too much power in comparison to the leaders of the tribes themselves. I think that the missionaries were not that effective or powerful that they were able to destroy their cultures. There were perhaps other factors that were more powerful than the missionaries themselves. But I don't see it in the response of any group of native peoples we worked with where they're, you know, the missionaries said, okay, you can't do that anymore, and they actually stopped doing that. It didn't work like that. It just did not work like that. History did not play out like that. Native peoples did not listen to the missionaries that well. Such is human nature.
And now you're still a missionary,
yes,
a professor at the University of St. Paul in, yes, Ottawa, Canada, still a missionary in this culture.
And an expert in missionary matters in this culture.
And so, as this culture seems to steam forward with technology just doubling and tripling seemingly every 6 months, and for me and many people like me, a seeming chasm growing between people of faith, let's not even say Catholic or Christian faith, let's say any kind of a sense of spirituality, of something greater than us, of this, that this comes to something. And on the other side of the chasm is, it seems to be, a very powerful culture saying, we're lucky monkeys. We just, hey, we lucked out. It's just, we come to nothing but plant food. This is it. Buy some stuff. Buy a new truck. You know, have an ice cream sundae. Congratulate yourself. Pat yourself on the back for just lucking out and being a human being. And then aloha on the Hawaiian guitar, you know? You're just out. Out. So you're a missionary in a culture like this. Do you think there will be a time when there can be solid bridges built across this chasm, or do you think that it's going to just widen?
I think that God has never stopped working as hard as ever to reach us. The human heart is vast on the inside and vastly complex, and perhaps becoming more complex to reach because of technology. But I do not doubt that even those people that claim to be lucky monkeys, as you say, I have some suspicions that they might be wrong when they look and see their own children who love them and look into their eyes, or they look into see the smile of their spouse in their face and go, there's something divine there. Or they look around life and the beauty of the world and say, why do I perceive this as beautiful? What is so wonderful about it that I perceive it as beautiful? I think just the perception of beauty, which is the inspiration of all art, really, is the greatest challenge to secularism there is. That we, the fact that we can recognize the beautiful and appreciate it and want it, it is the mirror reflection of heaven within us. That we see and can perceive something as beautiful. Granted, some people see a lot of money as a beautiful thing. Perhaps a lot of people. But
it's Dostoevsky.
Our perception can be wrong, but the fact that we perceive the beautiful is not wrong. It is preparation for heaven.
Right, I was just quoting Dostoevsky saying, beauty will save the world. Mm. And my question is, will it?
And my answer is yes. I think that there are three essential elements to human life. We would say they're beauty, truth, and love. And that those are the three avenues that reach the most secular heart. The most secular heart is still yelling, screaming, wanting in the most boisterous way to find beauty, truth, or love, any of the three or all three. And the fact that it exists all around them, and the fact that they're blind, deaf, incapable of perceiving the beauty and truth and love that surrounds them at every moment, is our call to mission. It's our call to proclaim someone who can open your eyes to it, to who can open your ears to it, who can open your heart to it, and really give you a real perception of what's going on. But I really think that God has not tired of us, thank goodness, knock on wood, knock, knock, and that is as intense as ever about reaching whoever we are, wherever we are, however we can be reached. And that the greatest clues that we have to this constant mission of God are precisely the existence and the need to perceive the beauty and the truth and the love which surround us. I think those are evangelical values which we can well represent within the life of the church and the life of grace in Jesus Christ.
Wow, Father Ron Young, thanks. Thanks for talking to me. Let's do it again. Can we
it's
do it again
sometime? It's been my great joy, and I'm sorry if I get overly theological, but, you know, that's what...
Hey, this is about the culture. This is about what's happening around us, and you're a part of what's happening around us.
Thank you.
And I think, and you're standing in the midst of the culture and saying, it's okay to be me, and it's okay to stand here, and I'll say what I have to say.
Amen. That's, I'm going to say it anyway.
Good for you. Let me... I just... this is additional... I'll just cut it. I took... Let me get it.
Yeah, cut whatever you find.
This is,
you know.
This is a crazy idea, and I have no idea. This may be a total failure, but I hadn't opened the book in 20 years, maybe. It's Thomas Merton, a Trappist monk of a... Why are you going,
Merton,
Yeah, is it interesting? An interesting character. In life and in the church.
And out of the church. Yeah.
And out of the church. And out of the church. And out of the church. Which late in his – well, he died in an accident, but he went to
he
the –
He was electrocuted in Italy,
in Asia. In India?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was in Asia.
Well,
yes.
India's in Asia.
Well, that's – okay. I'm going to cut that out so people know, you know, people know that I know that India's in Asia. I knew that. But so I took the book down. Not knowing, I hadn't looked in it for 20 years, and I have highlight places. I had actually used a highlighter this 20 or whatever years ago. And I thought at random I would read some of my highlighting, and we could talk about it. And I have no idea what I'm here's some – okay. In the book, pardon me, New Seeds of Contemplation by Thomas Merton – to some men, peace merely means the liberty to exploit other people without fear of retaliation or interference. To others, peace means the freedom to rob others without interruption. To still others, it means the leisure to devour the goods of the earth without being compelled to interrupt their pleasures to feed those whom their greed is starving. And to practically everybody, peace simply means the absence of any physical violence that might cast a shadow over lives devoted to the satisfaction of their animal appetites for comfort and pleasure. Many men like these have asked God for what they thought was peace and wondered why their prayer was not answered. They could not understand that it actually was answered. God left them with what they desired, for their idea of peace was only another form of war. And you cast your eyes. That was a pretty good one for just randomly picking out something.
Pretty random, all right.
That was – it was random.
Mm-hmm.
Do you disagree strongly with what he said?
Oh, absolutely not.
He for once, he hit one. He got a stand-up double. Once.
He was quite an insightful, brilliant man. There's no question about his spiritual insight and his wealth. But I would say the first words that Jesus says after the resurrection to the disciples are, peace be with you. But we misunderstand first the Hebrew sense of peace, and therefore the sense that Jesus is offering peace. The Greek sense of peace is a space without disturbance. So, of course, you don't want to be disturbed when you're robbing. You don't want to be disturbed when you're doing violence or whatever you want to do when you want to do it. No one wants to be disturbed. That's Greek peace. Nothing against the Greeks, but it's a Greek sense of peace. The Hebrew sense of peace is much better translated well-being, and it refers to the positive interrelationship of all the aspects of your life working together. So your physical, social, psychological, and spiritual aspects of your being, all of them, working together in a whole way in a positive direction. That's real peace. Notice that for all of that to work together, it has to include consciousness of the poor person that lives next to you, of the violated person that lives down the street, of the imprisoned person, of the homeless person, of the war and the inadequate use of social services, and it includes all of that as part of your peace, in the Judeo-Christian sense, huh? When all of that is working together, we are at peace. And as you take steps in your life to move toward that sense of wholeness, of well-being, you're moving toward peace. So it's a very different sense of peace than the Greek sense of peace, than the absence of disturbance. And therefore, I can agree with him that many times they want this kind of peace to precisely make war, whether it's against human nature or against their neighbor, they're still making war.
So you said when Jesus said, peace be with you, he didn't mean, may you not have disturbance.
Exactly. He meant, may all the parts of your life work together toward resurrection.
And in a sense, maybe he meant, may you have disturbance while you work through the disturbance in order to achieve what I see as peace.
Yeah, what I am. Hello, be
what
part
I am,
of the resurrection.
Right.
Yes, that's exactly right.
No wonder I invited you over. This is another one. Thomas Merton knew Seeds of Contemplation. He died in India, which is in Asia. But I knew that. When humility delivers a man from attachment to his own works and his own reputation, he discovers that perfect joy is possible only when we have completely forgotten ourselves. And it is only when we pay no more attention to our own deeds and our own reputation and our own excellence that we are at last completely free to serve God in perfection for his own sake alone. And continue here. He has planned to do spectacular things, meaning man. He cannot conceive himself without a halo. And when the events of his daily life keep reminding him of his own insignificance and mediocrity, he is ashamed, and his pride refuses to swallow a truth at which no sane man should be surprised. Did I highlight the right thing when I was a kid? Well, I wasn't a kid, but it was 20 years ago.
Well, I don't know about the right thing. I know that what I would say in response to that quotation, there's truth there. But we have to be careful, because many times in the spiritual life, people are running ahead of themselves. I remember during my novitiate, we had one guy, great guy. He said, I want to live extreme poverty. We were getting ready to take our vows for the first time, and he wanted to live with only a toothbrush. That's extreme poverty, right? And so his spiritual director said to him, okay, that's really great. The rest of us had alarm clocks and blankets and beds and all this other stuff, you know, pictures. And it wasn't exactly extreme poverty. So the spiritual director said, I want you to take everything that's in your room that you see as not participating in your sense of poverty and put it in a box. And we'll put it up in the attic and leave it there. If you don't need it, we'll burn it at the end of the year. So he wanted to get rid of it all. He wanted to burn it right away. But the spiritual director said, no, no, no. put it in a box. We'll save it all. And he and so now this guy was kind of a military guy. He'd been well trained in the art of warfare, and was somewhat of an expert at military violence. So he does this. He puts it all in a box, and all he has left in his room is a toothbrush. There's soap in the shower and everything, but a toothbrush. And the first day he comes out of his room, he's just a little bit crotchety. You could tell he's a little bit out of sorts. The second day he comes out of his room, he's snapping at people. The third day he comes out of his room, all you hear is this growl. The fourth day, the spiritual director told him to immediately go back into the attic, get all of his stuff out, and bring it down and put it back in his room right now. And he was ordered under holy obedience to do that. Because whatever his desire was, he was not spiritually ready to let go of his things. And we have a lot of people who will hear a quote like that and say, I can do that. I can just forget myself and forget who I am and leave myself aside, and I'm there. I'm spiritually there, which is arrogance of the first degree. I would say that rather we are called to slowly and gently make our way toward God. If you have a family, there is no way you can pretend that forgetting yourself equals forgetting that you have children. They have needs, and each person at their own age has their own needs. There's no way you could forget they're going to need ice cream cones and T-shirts and hamburgers to eat, and you know they're going to need the whole range of things that children need and need. There's no way you can forget yourself if you have a wife or a husband who needs your love and attention and your care and to get a flower now and again and to get some candy or some their favorite meal or whatever it is. You can't just forget about that stuff, be Mr. or Miss Unselfconscious, and pretend that no one else exists or has needs. So in the world of human relationships, you cannot pretend that you are at that level of spiritual development if God is calling your life in another direction. That quotation doesn't spell out when someone is actually the signs of when someone is spiritually ready for that kind of self-awareness. And I would not say that even forgetting about oneself and one's need for virtue and need for whatever is the highest level of spiritual life. The highest level of spiritual life is often where we began, with the simple, plain, unadorned, absolutely quiet love of God. It's the highest level of spiritual life. It's simple like God is simple. God's straightforward and simple. We're the ones that make all kinds of complexity out of things. That's because we're complex beings. That's our nature, designed by God. But God is essentially very simple, and the messages of God are quite straightforward. And as we journey through the spiritual life, I find that, for myself anyway, I started out very simple, I mean, almost in reverse gear, and slowly make my way forward into huge complexity. And then hopefully as I age, I will move back, further back, into a sense of simplicity once again. I don't know that forgetting about yourself is the highest virtue or the highest spiritual category. I do know there's a lot of people remembering themselves way too much in order to remember that there are others that love them and need them as well. And I do remember that there is an entire society who thinks of itself as much more important than any divine force behind it. So I think that we, as people aware of the spiritual life and aware of our need for God, grow towards simplicity. And if that includes the call to let go of our own agendas and our own concerns, It may well be that they're intended to be replaced by a higher agenda, something more fulfilling than what we latched onto in the first place. But I'm not convinced that just letting go of yourself and whatever you're aware of is better for the human person than keeping the commitments you yourself make as a faithful person, marriage, children, relationship, work, covenants, working a full shift, doing the best quality work you can offer, etc. I'm not convinced that isn't the highest virtue, that being Christian and true and steadfast in the most ordinary contexts, as I said before, God sees through our illusions. God is not fooled. And I think that we have to be very careful in where we see we've done our best work. When God looks, God's going to look and see how our family went, how our marriage went, how we treated ourselves with respect, how we made the world a better place because we were here. I don't think that should be any surprise to anyone that if you didn't do those things, God might not be overly impressed. So forgetting yourself, I'm not sure that's the highest stage of spiritual life. I do know that letting go of your own agenda is always part and parcel of allowing yourself to be free enough to hold on to God's, because God's agenda is quite big and quite involved. It involves the care of everyone you meet. There's a certain amount of letting go that has to happen before you really take that on as something you're willing to even try. And that requires certain spiritual development. But forgetting oneself, I'm not sure about that one. I don't think that's the highest virtue that God desires of us.
Good stuff. Now, I'm taking out Joel Osteen's hardback, How to Be a Winner. And I'd like you to comment on chapter 6.
What was the title of chapter 6 again?
You
can be
chapter
a winner,
center too. 7 is Winnie Win. Be a winning winner.
Now, okay, he's probably a very good man.
This is not going to be in it. I'm cutting this. It doesn't
loving
matter.
Loving God as he best can.
He does.
And so on.
He does.
And I think he's trying to be a very positive presence for people in our society. At the same time, now I speak as somebody who cares about the theological life, the idea of a winner in Christian life in early Christianity was always modeled by a martyr, someone who died and gave the ultimate sacrifice of their life, just like Jesus, to be like Jesus, was the winner. You had to die to be the winner in early Christianity. It wasn't pleasant. It involved prison and usually torture, and it wasn't pretty at all or clean or antiseptic. So the idea that the core value of Christian life is that you end up a winner, well, I guess you're a winner if you end up in heaven. But I'm not sure that seeing yourself as a worldly, wealthy, influential, powerful, and popular person in this world is going to get you heaven. You might ultimately lose and be a loser if you follow that kind of advice. There's nowhere in the Christian gospel, you look for it, he can look till the cows come home, he's not going to find any place where Jesus says, and if you want to be a winner, pick up your cross and follow. If you want to be a winner, give Joel Osteen or any of them more money. If you want to be a winner, say another prayer for Joel. It doesn't say that anywhere, and you're not going to find it.
Thanks for being here.
It was my great honor.
Well, thanks so much. That's kind of a long one, huh? But, I just thought different thing. The Big Pop Fun podcast. Father Ron has nothing to do with the entertainment industry. He's just an old friend, and I enjoyed talking with him. Thanks. thanks for listening. Thanks to Emily Wilson for producing. Thanks to Chris, Katie, everybody at Nerdist Industries for helping me out. Thanks to McPherson Guitars for helping me out on the live show. And thanks to you especially for listening, consider subscribing, or telling your friends. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.